We'll call the meeting of the House Committee on Health and Human Services order this morning. Good morning, colleagues. We are going to continue our presentation from Monday on the Department of Human Services and particularly the issue of child welfare. This morning, first on the agenda, I'd like to receive public comment from a couple of people who are invited. And I understand there's some members of the public that want to also participate, so while we're starting with the public comment, we'll review that list and we'll make sure we can accommodate everybody. So at this time, I'd like to invite Tina Kotek up for public comment.
Good morning, Chair Delta, members of the committee. Thank you for having me back. I have just some brief comments regarding the discussion on Monday. And the first thing I want to say, for the record, I'm sorry, my name is Tina Kotek. I'm the policy director with Children First for Oregon, and we're a statewide nonprofit advocating for children and families here in Salem and across the state. My first comment is really just a profound thank you for having this conversation. I was very impressed with the discussion on Monday, I think, in terms of the types of questions and the look at the system issues that we're dealing with. I think that the tone that you're setting with regard to these issues is really important. We have tragic incidents that happen, and it really raises public attention to the challenges that are facing our child welfare system. I think it's very important for this committee to be having those discussions and talking about it, so thank you very much for Monday and for what I'm assuming will be future hearings and informational gatherings around these issues. So thank you very much. All of you should have received a copy of our 2004 data book, and extra copies are coming around. We released that book last week, and there was a focus on child safety, looking at the numbers. And what we're seeing is we're seeing a system under stress. The reports of suspected abuse over the last decade have gone up 61%, while at the same time our child population has gone up 10%. I think it would be safe to say that the resources into our child protective services and our overall child welfare system have not gone up 61%. The state is doing the best job it can do with the limited resources it has. We are supportive of Assistant Director Foley and her staff trying to get at the system issues, but the numbers are showing that we're seeing more children who are founded victims of abuse and neglect. We're seeing more children entering foster care than exiting. And frankly, we're not seeing increased investments to deal with those issues at the system level. So I'd be happy to answer questions in the data book, but I'm sure you've probably had a chance to look at it already. One of the things I wanted to mention is to encourage you to have other discussions. One of the things that was raised on Monday by Assistant Director Foley was the relation between child welfare and self-sufficiency programs, specifically TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, and the overlap with some of the caseload in the TANF caseload and child welfare. I think that's a very interesting discussion because ultimately we want to also prevent these issues from happening. We want to help families when they're in crisis and when they need help before it gets to the point where a child is abused, neglected, or dies, which is not what we want to see. And I think I would encourage you to come to have a hearing just around that TANF issue. I think the department is trying to figure out why we have families who enter into the TANF system and then become connected with child welfare and why that is. We hear stories about some families who, because it is difficult to get assistance through TANF, that some of them will actually voluntarily have their children put into the child welfare system because they'll get more support. And I don't think that's what we want to see. I think we want to see families being helped on the front end. Unfortunately, the TANF program hasn't been, the eligibility levels and the cash assistance levels have not increased since 1991. So you have a system that is supposed to be about children and keeping them safe and healthy, but not really providing those services at the level we need. So I think that's a discussion you're going to want to have, because my final comment is, the conversations here are related to what's happening in Ways and Means. You have some budget discussions going on, some cuts that are recommended in the governor's budget that will can ultimately undermine what you're trying to do here, which is to strengthen the system. When we're looking at reductions in special rates to foster care families, when we're looking at reductions in system of care, flexible funding for foster care, not seeing increased caseworkers at the line level, the folks who deal with those calls that come in, those are, when you have those investment issues, that's going to affect your ability to solve the problems that you're going to be discussing now and in the next, you know, couple weeks, I'm assuming. So I would just encourage you to continue the conversation you're having and to thank you for doing this. For those of us who work on child safety issues, you're asking the right questions, and we will be what support we can in terms of providing you data or additional testimony around specific issues in the coming weeks. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Yeah, not in regard to your testimony here, but in regard to the organization Children First.
Yes.
Several years ago, I tried to communicate with your organization regarding what I thought to be a serious methodological error in the compilation of some of the data that you had. I never was able to get a response to any of my communication. And as a consequence, you'll excuse me, but I've kind of put Children First off on the back burner when I get anything from them because of the lack of communication with your group. And that may be that I should have followed up in subsequent periods. And I apologize for not doing that, but I'm wondering if there's some reason or if there's been some change that this type of thing might not be happening now.
Chair Dalton, Representative Jensen, I appreciate the comments. I've been with the organization for about 2 years, so I'm not familiar with the situation. However, I have the fullest confidence in the numbers that we do have. We attempt to get the most recent data that we can. We double-check it and triple-check it, and are always interested in hearing if there are concerns about the numbers. Our job, we feel, is to provide the best data we can, because I think, and I have, you know, complete confidence in our numbers, and I think that data should drive policy decisions. So I'm hoping, I'd be happy to meet with you. We can talk about some of your concerns, because I do want each and every one of you to feel confident that what you're receiving from us is accurate, and I have every faith that it is, but I'd be happy to chat with you about that. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tina, I may have misunderstood what you said, but you're talking about overlap between Children's Services and TANF. Were you implying that you would like to see TANF workers using their time to kind of evaluate and oversee problems that might be coming down the line in order to make the time that's available to evaluate kids more effective between the two? Is that what you were saying?
Chair Delta, Representative Anderson, I'm not an expert on staffing issues. The point I was trying to make is there is some overlap, and the department is addressing that. They have dedicated some staff time and some resources to look at the TANF program as a children's program and to look at, are there families who are connected with both systems, TANF and child welfare, and how do those workers communicate and work together? My broader point is, are families receiving the services they need when they are in a financial crisis? Are they receiving the assistance and the services in terms of alcohol and drug counseling, mental health? Do they have access to housing supports, child care? Because if we can keep the families stable when they are in crisis, we're more likely to prevent them from having to go into the child welfare system, because a family in crisis, whether it's unemployment or access to mental health or health care services that they need, there will be detrimental effects on the children. And ultimately, it's more cost-saving if we can do the prevention on the front end, which is what I'd like to see. Thank you.
President Tomei.
Thank you. Thank you for coming and being willing to come back again after you weren't able to speak on Friday. Do you have any specific recommendations other than funding? It sounds like funding. You're saying that initially the whole agency is underfunded, so there are fewer workers who can follow up on suspected abuse and neglect, whatever. So are there other specific recommendations that you would make?
Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei. That's a good question. I think it's unrealistic to think that money will solve everything.
Right.
I think what the governor is doing in terms of the CERT process, in terms of looking at system issues, looking at how we can do things more effectively, is important. I think the outside audit of the processes in the Portland area is really important. I would just hope that there are certain things you can do in terms of efficiencies and better systems, but I do think there's a good possibility that person's going to come back and say, there's a point at which you need an adequate level of staffing or an adequate information system. I think with the governor in his budget around some additional dollars to update the child welfare information system is important to deal with some of the data flow issues. But I think it's very complicated. Certainly, what we could do to increase the number of foster care families so we can deal with some of the back-end issues where families, children who with high needs, older kids are staying in foster care longer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, really galvanizing the community to become more involved. It's not a simple just throw more money at it. I think those outside audit issues are really important to look at what the system really needs, and if that is additional investments, that we do that so we can keep our kids safe.
Thank you. One of the issues that we talked about with Ramona Foley on Friday was how difficult it is in some of the rural counties that may be an hour or two away from the office to investigate a report or whatever. But it's interesting to me that of the reports of neglect or abuse, that, what was the proportion? The state reviewed, I can't remember, 42,000. They reviewed 42,000, and I'm not finding the half, but I understand that it was about half. But in the smaller counties, Baker and Malheur, 9 out of 10 reports were investigated. I'll ask Ramona this too, but do you have any sense on how that is, whereas in Multnomah and Washington counties, which would be more compact counties, only 36% were investigated?
Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei, that's a really good question. And I have to say we're still trying to understand the correlation there, because you'll see in some counties, the rural counties, some as 70-80% of the reports that come in, they do investigate them further. That could be a size issue in terms of the proportion of the number of children related to the staff. It could be a staffing issue. It could be just local processes, how they might prioritize them more. I would really like to have the answer to that question, because I think it might be good to maybe bring in some folks from the rural areas and say, what are you seeing in your communities and how does that reflect what you're able to do? But you also see in some of those counties who investigate more, they also have more founded cases. One of the things that strikes me is we really don't know the full extent of what abuse and neglect looks like in this state, because there's always underreporting. You're not able to follow up on every single report. And so to see more founded cases in those places that are investigating more makes me think if we were investigating at least 10% more in the metro area, how much larger might our numbers be? So I think getting at why there are those differences would be very interesting, and I'm maybe System Director Foley might have an answer to that.
All right. Thank you, Tina.
Thank you, Tina. Chair Dalto and Vice Chair Tomei, for the record, I'm Ramona Foley, Assistant Director at the Department with Children, Adults, and Families. As we mentioned on Monday, one of the issues is that we have to staff at a certain level to make sure that reports are responded to. So in counties or clusters of counties where it's 2 hours from the office out to a community, we still have to have a minimal level of staffing. I think what has happened over the years is there's an expectation in some of those rural communities that anything that gets reported, someone's going to go out on. Either law enforcement or child welfare will go out, and sometimes they go out together. Sometimes it's quicker for law enforcement to make that first visit than it is child welfare. And when you move over into urban areas, what you have is more of a mindset to triage. I've got a volume of calls coming in. I have to decide which ones, and when we talk about this process a little later this morning, which ones am I going to send some somebody out on immediately, which ones within 5 days, and then which ones are not going to have someone go out on. And I think what it really tests us to think about is, should we be looking at our staffing in those urban areas? I think they're doing a better job now than they did 5 years ago in terms of how many cases actually get a face-to-face, but I think it's one of the things the national expert is really asking us to think about, how we do that screening in the first place. The other thing that happens in urban areas is many of these families will access all the services that are available in the community. And then when you move to the rural areas, there aren't those services in the community. There's very few services out that refer families to. So the worker who is having to triage is thinking, can this family get help from a private nonprofit if I make a referral? So I think it's excellent information that this report has provided. I was pleased to hear Tina's comment about accuracy, because much of it is information we have to provide her. So that made me feel heartened, I guess, about the accuracy. But it does raise a lot of questions, and I think these are good questions that we need to be looking further into.
If I could just follow up with that, Ramona. So it concerns me a lot that in the smaller counties, when they do follow up on these reports, that they're more serious, the reports are founded. There is a reason for them to be there. And it concerns me, and I wonder if it concerns you, that if Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, Columbia counties only visit 36% of these folks, then they're missing a lot of potential cases.
Chair Dalto and Vice Chair Tomei, it does concern me, and I think it's a logical argument that if we were out there seeing more of these families, we probably would be bringing more of these families into the child welfare system. Again, I don't think we have scientific answers at this point, and the interesting thing is all of these counties are operating under the same law, and they're all operating under the same rules and something called a guided assessment process. And that process was put in place a couple of years ago to really try to get at this issue around the variance from one county to the other. I would say that when you look across other states as well, every state has the same issue. We have not yet found a state where the same level of intervention will happen across all rural and urban counties, or the same level of intervention in terms of what gets substantiated and does not get substantiated. But it's a concern to us, and it's a concern, I think, for citizens, because you'd want to think the same decision that got made in Ontario would be the same decision that would be made in Multnomah. Mm-hmm. And that's not where we're at right now when we look at these figures.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. President Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't help myself but jump on that same bandwagon. In rural Oregon, and I think Representative Green will bear this out as well, in rural Oregon, typically the families are more homogenous, and they typically look after one another. And I can't help but think of my local adoption group that works with CASA and the Department of Human Services and monitor very closely the number of people, the number of young children who are actually being placed and then eventually adopted. And they're very concerned about that to make sure that those standards are met. Now, while in metropolitan Oregon, you may have a number of people that are very concerned about that and very anxious and help get that that job done, get the water to the end of the row, as we say in rural Oregon. Mm-hmm. Just a few people in rural Oregon that are involved in those kinds of things are proportionally much more in number. And typically we will find more relatives and family and other people that are easily accessed and known to those people that are called to serve on those boards, known as family members, known as resources in the community. So I think perhaps even on the ratios of the same number of professional workers that are sent out from the state in relationship to the ratio of children in a community, within rural Oregon, typically families are more involved, the community is more involved, and as Director Foley has indicated, the police agencies and other folks that are involved feel a tremendous responsibility and a connection to the child, because they know that if they don't address those children issues very early on, very quickly, that they will see those children pop back up in other portions of the system much sooner.
Thank you.
I just have one final question, I guess, on this presentation. Do you have data to compare Oregon incidences of child abuse or allegations of child abuse as compared to other states? Because I didn't notice it when I received the book initially.
Chair Dalto, that's a good question. It's difficult to compare abuse and neglect statistics across states because they do have different laws, different processes, so it's very complicated. The federal government is doing system reviews of all the states, and System Director Foley could probably address some of that, and there are some benchmarks around things that we could be striving for, but to compare, you know, who has more abuse in which state, you can't really do that, unfortunately.
Okay. I appreciate you being here this morning. Thanks for being
here. Yeah, thank you very much.
Resource for us. All right. Before I sort of continue on with the public comment, I just wanted to let the audience know there. I have four people signed up that I will invite up to, from members of the public that will invite up to offer some public testimony. So it's my intention to try to get through the public comment period maybe within the next 20, 25 minutes so that we can get to the rest of our agenda because we have a pretty full agenda, but we'll sort of reassess when we have an opportunity. Representative Greenlee, did you want to make a comment before we move on?
Oh, yes. I'd be very happy to do so today, sir. A front-page story in the Oregonian reported on the benchmark of how the state citizens feel about the state of Oregon, and one extremely distressing thing that came up was the fall in the percent of the population that's positive about the government's work in making access to health care available. In the year 2000, 66% of the population, which isn't great, suggested that we were doing an adequate job, and that dropped in just 4 years to 45%. We obviously have a crisis, and recently also there was a survey done by the Oregon Health Policy Commission, done by Oregon Health Decisions for the Oregon Health Policy Commission, that indicated more than 80% of the citizens of Oregon think access to health care, basic health care at least, is a right of the citizens. I hope we take this seriously in our agenda, and I may comment on the floor later, but I hope this committee takes this seriously in our agenda and finds time over this next session to explore ways that we can help improve access to health care for the citizens of Oregon, as I'm sure you have in mind, but it just moved me to the article today. It was a little embarrassing as a legislator to see that precipitous drop in just 4 years and how the citizens view us as doing our job. Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Yeah, Representative Greenlee, we appreciate your comments. And I suppose I might invite you to come up with a concept for, a hearing that might address that issue. Great. In particular, so that we can explore some of those issues in depth. So appreciate your adding to the process. I think we'll continue along with the public comment portion now, and we'll invite Jessica Stevens from SEO Local 503 and two colleagues, I think, who will be joining her.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question to the administrator while we're in process? Sandy, we received some written testimony, which I assume becomes public record when we receive it as a committee. What are the standards about the use of names of children and families and things like that? I got a little nervous as to the extent to which we might be violating confidentiality in accepting testimony without blocking out names, or some of these must be in the public record and others not. Where are we?
Let's have the committee stand at ease for a moment and explore that issue. down. We're trying to figure out, since we haven't come across a situation where we were accepting public testimony by the form of written testimony that referenced specific children, specific families, and very sensitive, potentially sensitive issues. So we're going to go to legislative council and get some guidance about how to accept public testimony that does so to appropriately protect any sort of confidentiality issue. So while we're doing that, we're going to continue with this panel, and then by the time the panel has concluded their comments, I think we'll have some guidance on how to go. So, good morning, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Dalton, members of the committee. My name is Jessica Stevens. I work with SEIU Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union, and we represent a lot of the frontline, most of the frontline workers in the Department of Human Services that work with children and our most vulnerable Oregonians. So, just going to have folks introduce themselves and speak to the issues, and if you have questions, we're here to help and help figure out how to better serve our kids.
Thank you, Chair Dalton, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Cochran, and I'm a child welfare caseworker. I've been employed with agency since 2000 as I've worked as a young children's permanency caseworker. I'm currently working as a permanency facilitator to help caseworkers achieve permanency more quickly for children. And I wanted to talk to the committee today about staffing issues. Currently, caseworkers are working very hard to meet all the expectations to provide safety and stability for the children that we work with and to make sure that they have permanency, whether it's with their own family or through an alternative resource. My understanding is that the practice for figuring out staffing allocations was originally created in the 70s, and that practice is still in place. And the structure of casework has changed tremendously since that time. It's still the same basic purpose of safety for children, but the amount of work that needs to be done to make that happen has changed. The department has presented in recent times a lot of wonderful new policies and practice that have been put in place to help with safety and stability for children. I think some of the more notable ones have been the 30-day face-to-face contact with children, which is a very important one. The TDMs, which are team decision meetings or family decision meetings, where you're planning and you're getting together family members and community partners, so there's a lot more collaboration coming on. But when these policies came into place, there was no, it wasn't taken into account how they would affect workload. And I think that in order to implement important policies that come into place, you need to have the tools to do so. And one of those important tools is to have adequate staffing to be able to care for the families and the children that we work with. I think a good example of the increased workload that's come about due to these important policies, I had a coworker who was talking about just this last month, he had 68 face-to-face visits that he needed to accomplish, and that was on top of all the other important work that happens. And workers try very hard to get all of that done, and it's very important, but without adequate staffing, it's difficult to meet the needs of our children and our families that we work with. I think that with a lot of the new procedures that are coming in place, that through the CERT team, I was lucky enough to be able to sit on that committee that created that process, as well as the reviews that are going on, I think that there will be some very good recommendations about problems that are happening in the agency, and I think it's important to take into account as we implement those new procedures the importance of having adequate staffing to be able to effectively implement those.
I have a question about the circumstance you cited about your colleague and the 68 face-to-face visits, the 30-day visits that were queuing up. How long did your colleague anticipate they would take to be able to process all those face-to-face visits to catch up with the backload?
Thank you, Chair Dalto. And, you know, that wasn't a backload. It's just part of the policy. You have to see children every 30 days, parents every 30 days. And then foster parents, I believe it's every 60 days. And I can't speak for him. We didn't talk. But as a caseworker, my average visit with a child, I tried to stay for approximately an hour, which in the scheme of things, it's an hour a month that you're seeing a child. It's really even not that much. And driving time, it takes a good amount of time to get to those visits every month. And then face-to-face with parents, you try and sit down and have time to talk with them about services and how they're doing. So I don't have a good answer for you as a number of times that if we figure each visit, even on the short end, would take 30 minutes to an hour. You know, you're still looking at 30 to 60 hours.
Well, then based on your experience, how many face-to-face visits are you able to do in a day and still manage your workload?
I guess the best answer I can give you is that all workers try your best to get in all 30 of those face-to-face for the children and all of the face-to-face for the parents. And I think it's difficult to get all of it done, but that all workers try their best because they realize the importance of it.
Chair, can I follow?
Person Greenlee.
I was intrigued with the critical case analysis, whatever it was, forget the name of that, now that we looked at the other day, that commented on this critical case that frequency of visits seemed there, but that the paperwork following the frequency of visits did not seem very adequate. And I was intrigued with the notion in which you have information technology backup. You have the ability to easily and simply document the cases that you've seen. I think you should be commended, and I think seeing the kids is obviously the most important thing, but one of the things we know in the healthcare field is if it's not in the record, it didn't happen. And that makes this process difficult. How do you see the ease in getting the documentation on those cases into the record?
Thank you, Chair Feltzel, Representative Greenlee. I think that they have a system that makes it fairly easy to type in the documentation, and the department has set up a wonderful system so that anyone else within child welfare can also access that information in case needed. You know, if you need it for a case, anyone can pull it up, and I think that's very important. The system can be slow, and I think that workers do their best to prioritize. They try and get the actual face-to-face contact in first, and then, you know, work hard to get that documentation in, and sometimes workers do get behind in making sure that it gets into the appropriate program, and I believe it's cases that probably hold it. I think that the agency is working hard to come up with some alternative processes to make that system more effective. I know, for example, that they're working with a program called Cyber Secretaries that's going to be implemented at least on a trial basis where you can call in and dictate. You've finished a home visit, you can call in, you can dictate, and they will type up those notes for you. And I think a great benefit of that is not only do those notes get typed up and you have that documentation, it can also happen directly after a visit. And so you have very good documentation that can adequately describe what you were doing during that visit.
Let me follow up briefly. You said in your answer to this question that they have a system rather than we have a system. Is there anything that should be read into that?
No, I apologize. it's as far as cyber secretaries, it will be. I'm not using it currently. Our brand.
I'm sorry, you don't have to answer that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sarah, I didn't catch. What is your unit that you work with? Is it a county?
I work for the Gresham Child Welfare Office
as
a permanency worker.
How many folks are in your unit total?
Our office has approximately 100 workers. My unit that's supervised by my supervisor has approximately 10 workers.
So it's 1 to 10 caseworkers, 1 administrator to 10 caseworkers?
It depends on the unit. I think one unit has as many as 18 workers under one supervisor, but somewhere in between 10 and 18.
Okay, thank you. Just on that last cyber. There are programs too where you can dictate, and it's word transmission right into the computer. And I would think that might be another alternative that we could be thinking about. I don't know if it requires a laptop or something with you. I know. In some of the police departments around, they have it right with them in the car and can dictate the case right now, and it's into Word form. But that might be a consideration we look at. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't get over how much this presentation sounds like a Ways and Means presentation. I assume that Jessica and Sarah, you folks have have performance standards and goals that you are required to meet. Have you made your presentation to the Ways and Means Health and Human Services folks at this particular point with these concerns, expressing these concerns?
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, at this time we have not, but absolutely plan to do that. I think that Tina spoke a little bit to the connectedness of this process and thinking about the funding of the agency, and I think, you know, as we talk about workload and resources, we do face this challenge, and in these difficult budget times of how can we do the best with the lack of resources that we have, and I think that you know, the agency and the employees are certainly working hard to try to figure that out. But we will absolutely be making the case to Ways and Means, because that certainly is where, when it comes down to it, you can only do so much work with so many staff, with so many resources. And so things do fall off the plate. And so we will definitely be advocating down the hall as well.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up, if I may. You do have some performance standards and some performance measurements, some definite outcomes. Are you achieving your outcomes?
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, I think the agency might be able to better speak to the Global Performance Measure report.
Excuse me, let me interrupt just at that point, Mr. Chair. You don't know your performance outcomes, what you're supposed to produce on a regular daily basis?
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, I personally am not a caseworker, but I will ask Sarah and Yvonne to speak to that a little bit. What I will say is I know that our members are working as hard as they can and doing the best that they can and working above and beyond what is probably normally possible on a day-to-day basis. And I know that we feel like we're not doing enough, and that there isn't enough time in the day to serve all the needs of all the children of Oregon who are part of the system. So I think that with more staffing, with more resources, we could do more. I think folks are, I mean, like so many agencies and so many services in Oregon right now, we're doing the best we can with what we have. So I can have folks answer questions about specific.
Okay, just say, Mr. Chair, that when we come to the staffing levels, the performance standards, the actual outcomes and measurements of those outcomes, when we talk about providing the computer assistance and other backup assistance and those kinds of things, those are all Ways and Means issues. And while I appreciate what you're bringing to us, we're not the folks here that will make the decision on your Ways and Means appropriation. You'll have to make your case as to your, and not just outputs, but actual outcomes. Are we being successful with the families that we are reaching? Are we spending an hour with the parents, or an hour with the foster parents, or an hour with the children, and are we getting the water to the end of the row? Are we making a difference in the lives of a few in that process? And that's, I, again, my background in this prior history in this institution, Mr. Chair, has been Ways and Means, and I can't help it. This all looks like a Ways and Means hearing when you're making that pitch to us, but we're looking at the agency from a more holistic view as opposed to the Ways and Means end of it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Tomei.
Thank you very much.
If I could just, do you mind, Representative, if I just respond quickly to that?
Sure.
Thank you very much. Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, I very much appreciate your perspective on that, and I know you have a lot of experience in the budget process, and so I'm glad that you serve on this committee as well. I do want to say that we want to provide, as Representative Tomei had asked of Tina before, are there ideas, are there solutions within the resources that we're currently working to make things better, to change things a little bit more? And Sarah spoke a little bit about updating the case management system, which was designed in the 70s. There are some ideas. We want to be available to answer those questions in addition to, you know, fund more staff. We want to be a resource for you in that, and we'll continue to do that here in this room. I'm sorry. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I missed the early part of your presentation. Maybe you talked about this. Sarah and Yvonne, is that right? And you're both caseworkers? Thank you. Can you tell us what proportion of time is spent, like, in visiting with children, in visiting with foster family, in visiting with the biological family, and what proportion is spent in the office? And I know it's not just doing office work, but it's also talking with your supervisor, and it's talking with other agencies, it's doing a triage. I mean, it's not just 30 children you're dealing with. You're dealing with multiple agencies and families. So could you give us sort of an idea of what proportion is maybe spent on those activities?
That's difficult. Thank you.
I know.
Also, Representative Tomei. I would say that the majority of time is spent in the office or in court hearings,
yeah,
or meetings with providers. I know from my perspective, we try and meet with our supervisor twice a month to go over every case. And then she has an open door policy. Although it's difficult with all of everything going on to get adequate supervision, and that's no fault of the management. I would say probably about 25% of the time is spent directly with families, and I don't know.
I was going to say 30-70. 30% with families, 70% paperwork and other duties.
That's a good percentage. I would have guessed somewhat different. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Boone, a very brief question.
Very brief, and just a comment. I just wanted to say it just reminds me of this process, being new to this process. You can be overwhelmed by the paperwork and the complexity of all the issues and how to get it all together, and you know you have to go home at the end of the day. You could work 24 hours a day. It never ends. So I think one of the things I'd like to hear at some point, not today maybe, is how we can help facilitate your jobs by helping you take care of yourselves too, and I don't know if any of you are marathon runners, but apply those same tactics to your job too, so that you kind of even it out. I worry about you.
Thank you.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just the comments, Mr. Chairman, more than it is the question. Comments from my perspective as a legislator and dealing with constituent issues that you folks are on the line for. I have nothing but admiration for the caseworkers throughout the state of Oregon, if they're at all like the caseworkers that I come in contact with in my district. The caseloads that you have are certainly astronomical, and it's very difficult to keep track of all of them. But in comment to that, one of the things I've personally observed, Mr. Chair, every time I've called a caseworker about John Doe, they know it right off the top. I mean, it's not a matter of, I got to go run and look things up. Now, perhaps those are, perhaps that's not a good sample, because those may be high-profile cases. I can't speak to that. Only thing I can speak to is that my personal experience with them as a legislator is they really know their cases, they know what they're doing, they know what the problems are, and my hat is off to you. I think it's got to be one of the toughest jobs that anyone can go into. And you must have a masochistic complex. I don't know anybody, sure. But, so I appreciate the work you do. I appreciate your understaff. I appreciate the paperwork is voluminous. But unfortunately, good, bad, or indifferent, the world we live in today with the areas Representative Butler is talking about accountability, you got to have the paperwork in order to have a measure of accountability. And, in a way, my apologies for that, but until some divine revelation comes, I don't know a way around it at this point. And again, thank you very much for what you do for Oregon and the children of Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. Yvonne, do you have Yvonne,
my name is Yvonne Rakia, and I'm a caseworker. I've worked for the state 5 years this April, and I used to be a permanency worker for 4 years, and now I'm an extended screener. My title is the CARES liaison. So I handle cases in Multnomah County that are usually third-party sexual abuse cases. I have a very different job than most caseworkers, but I did want to speak to my coworkers and what they're experiencing. Again, I just want to piggyback on what she said, that staffing is so critical. When you're looking at the lives of children, keeping children alive and safe, I mean, we're right out there, we're dealing with these people, and it's important for us to have enough people to get the work done. Because when we don't, children die. And we have to live with that, and we have to go home with that. And, for instance, and there's a branch in the Multnomah County that all of the PS workers, which are protective service, so they take the cases right up front. They are completely overwhelmed. They can't get rid of their cases because there's nowhere for them to go. The permanency or the ongoing workers are fully, their caseloads are full. But these cases have to move. Most of the permanency workers in this particular branch have been there a month to 4 months. They're not equipped to deal with some of the issues that these families have. When I started with the agency, most people that worked in my office had been there 10, 15 years. I'm like a dinosaur, and I've been there 5 years. It's just the way things have changed. It's so hard to describe how things have changed and how much harder it's gotten and the effect that it's been having on caseworkers. And I really appreciate your comment, Representative Boone, because the most important thing, I think, is retaining staff and treating staff respectfully. I think the agency has been taking a lot of steps towards doing that. They've been having this training, the Paul Axel training, which is kind of working with management and staff and looking at how they can better support caseworkers. But it truly is a crisis in the field. And I just appreciate you letting us be here today and talk about this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yvonne, is part of the problem just the emotional nature of the work, the trauma sometimes that you see in families or with the children, or is it the recording? Is it the record keeping? Is it the time taken there? That, and maybe there's a balance between those. What would you say on that?
Chair Dalto, Representative Anderson, I would say it was a combination of those things. Certainly the job that we do is extremely draining emotionally, and so we need that support. But also, when you are dealing with those things, and they're so important, and you don't have enough time to address them, that's just critical, and that's what we're seeing. So it's a combination of those things. I know that workers that I've talked to that have worked for the agency for like 20 years tell us about the good old days when they had a staff that would take their notes and type them up for them, and we've lost that over the years. And at the same time, the responsibilities have become greater, and the amount of documentation that we're expected to provide has become greater. So the burden is falling on us, and that's really what it feels like, that those of us in the field, that we're carrying the weight of the problems of all these families, and we're doing the best that we can, and at the same time we're constantly criticized by the media, we're criticized by our peers, we go to court, we're screamed at, we're humiliated, we don't have representation in court, whereas every other legal party that works with these families has legal representation, we don't. So I think there's a lot of ways that there's a lot of things that make it difficult to do our job.
Well, I certainly appreciate all of you coming down this morning and taking this opportunity. You know, we know that you're doing a terrific job and that you care about these kids very much and you care about the system. And I appreciate the perspective that you're going to add to this discussion, because we are going to continue to do a lot of work, even beyond this hearing and the next couple of hearings. But it's my hope that we can incorporate everything that we've learned, including the comments from you, to come up with some kind of guidance for the system for the future. So I appreciate you being here, Rick.
Thank you
very much. Right. Well, we are falling a little bit behind, as we usually do in human services. We have four people signed up for public testimony. I'm going to ask that the members of the public that I invite up limit their comments to about 3 minutes, if possible. And the other thing is, we're going to be very careful until the chair makes a decision about how to accept written comments that reference specific cases or specific individuals. So I would ask that you focus your interaction with this committee in the public record through your verbal comments. So I'm going to reserve the right to refuse to accept certain written testimony until we sort of have a definitive idea of how we're going to handle that. So with that said, I'll invite Angela O'Halloran up, and I'm not sure if Angela here? Okay, and did you have somebody with you?
Kristen Hilfiger.
Okay, well, I'll invite Kristen Hilfiger up as well.
Mr. Chair, could we also caution witnesses in their verbal testimony to be cautious about using other names other than their own?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Representative Greenlake, so for the members of the public who are going to come and offer public testimony, I'd ask you to be very careful not to interject information about specific cases that might violate the privacy of a specific child or individual. So I ask you to be mindful of that. So thank you very much. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Representative Balco and committee.
Can I ask you to introduce yourself?
Oh, one second. I'm Angela O'Halloran. I'm a foster parent. And I believe part of what you're discussing is the written testimony that I've put forth. And I apologize. All the names and incidences have been in the newspaper, so that's the only reason why I did use them. I certainly was not any sense trying to... I'm a foster parent, right? I completely understand confidentiality. I also think there's a time and a place where things just need to be said. So I apologize for anything. So... I'm Angela O'Halloran, and I am a foster parent. We've been fostering for about 11 years now. We've had over 250 kiddos in our home. Currently, we have 5 special needs children. They're all permanent foster care, so that means we get to raise them up. We range in age from 6 to 20. And, in fact, we also have our 5 biological children. So we have a total of 10. So we have a pretty busy house. My husband and I are very active in advocating for children and for foster parenting, as we think that both of those team together are very important. My comments today are going to be really, we've heard a lot of big picture things, and my comments are more going to be actual to the events that did happen recently, and perhaps some ways we can specifically help this crisis, because that's what it is. It's definitely a crisis. Our children are not safe. Recently, we've heard numerous reasons, and they're true reasons. There's the money issue. There's the increased children in care. Methamphetamine use is on the rise. All of those are real. But I would strongly urge the committee to understand and not allow DHS to hide behind those things and make excuses out of them. Out of all the workers that we have had, we've had excellent, truly, 11 years, excellent workers. And the foster parents we know are excellent foster parents. So the majority of the people you're looking at are people who are working hard and doing their job. But what we need to look at specifically is policies and procedures that are in place. There's the GAPS program that's in place. That's the mandatory reporting piece. There's the teaming, because there isn't a lot of money. The caseworkers are completely, their caseloads are very, very high. And as far as the face-to-face issue goes, it doesn't count if my certifier comes out and she comes out and she sees my kids and she sees me, she meets with me. That doesn't count as a face-to-face. It has to be the worker. So our thinking is until this gap is bridged with the money issue, so we have the Ways and Means Committee and we can figure out where we need the money to go and to help the workers and to help the system, we right now need an interim system that's going to bridge it. So our thinking is get everybody teaming together. The communication, the CERT report, that was all over in the CERT report, that there has to be better communication. If you have the workers and their assistants and the case managers, everybody working together, then you're going to get more and more of your face-to-face visits, and you're going to get information. You know, have a little checklist that has a little blurb of the primary reason you'd be seeing the kiddos, just a little blurb, and then a checklist just to make sure. A, it's going to be written, so you have your written, and it's going to be done. Also, we need to talk about duplication of services. Multnomah County currently has a medical tiered program that's working. It's working successfully, and it's keeping children safe. Clackamas County has been offered this. It's my understanding they're working on their own. And my thought is, again, in the interim, why reinvent the wheel? We already have this system, and it's already working very well. So take what's already working, adjust it to what you have, and use it. In these cases that have been in the newspaper recently, there were gaps that the children slipped through, and it was because there wasn't a specific system designed to close that up, and it wasn't in place. I think, in general, since I've written a letter, I've had senators and representatives call me, email me, and say, okay, Angela, what do you want us to do? And I think it's reasonable to ask a timeline. In the CERT report, there was specific 6 out of 8 of the recommendations said that the state office needed to go, central office needed to go in and train. So I'd like to see that on a timeline. It's nice to know they're going to. And I was very excited, actually, to see the CERT report and to see that they took this seriously and that they were really working to make this better. But I want it real. I think it can't just be an idea. It has to be actuality. So thank you.
I appreciate your comments very much. Okay. Now, Kristen Hilfiger. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Dalto and committee members. My name is Kristen Hilfiger. My husband and I have been foster parents for 18 years. We don't have 250 kids in it through our house because we sort of take children that no one else can do or want, and then they grow up in our house and go on. I'm also a registered nurse. I'm a Tier 4 medical foster parent in Multnomah County. And basically what that means is that the children in my home are so medically fragile that some of them breathe with a respirator, some of them are trached, they have behavior issues. I have a great deal of help in my home. I have registered nurses that work when I leave, that are there if the kids are home. I have a significant amount of aides. My funding stream comes from developmental disabilities, from medically fragile children's unit, as well as child welfare. Angela and I and a number of foster parents have been real involved in working on the set of child rules and safety standards for developmental disabilities about 8 or 9 years ago. Part of the children who were in the state custody of child welfare, their funding stream went to developmental disabilities in the hope that they would be better met by having case managers who understood delays in developmental disabilities. At that time, they promised that there would be no duplication of services. And we worked, and one of the things that they promised is that we could have input with the standards. So we did it then, and we just did it again when they were all rewritten and the language was adjusted, and they were just adopted in January. I also have served on the CAPTA panel for the Multnomah County Region, which stands for Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, and it's a citizen review board for how CPS, how the agency works with child abuse. I also volunteer by doing hospital assessments. She was talking about the medical program, by doing hospital assessments on my own time, where I go in, do sort of a paper review, talk to the nurses, and see what the needs of the children who are being placed in foster care are. And then I make a recommendation, not about foster home, but about what level of care the children will need. And we do this so that it decreases the amount of moves for children, so that we don't overwhelm foster parents, so that the kids go where they need to go. I'd just like to say that in my 18 years of being a foster parent, 100-some-odd caseworkers, probably more like 200, I've had two that I considered bad. Two out of 200. They work very, very hard. We're very fortunate in Multnomah County in the medical program to have a wonderful three certifiers who back us up and go to bat for us. In addition, Jerry Burns, who's the regional director, Judy Griswold, Carolyn Graff, are all absolutely wonderful, and they get us what we need if they can. They listen, they interface. We're very fortunate and very grateful. And I think that the crisis today is really because parents and families don't have social services. They don't have safety nets. They can't fall back on social services. And the kids that come into care now are sick children. They're broken children. If they can manage, they stay in their homes. We have kids, I see kids, babies with broken bones and who have been neglected and not fed and starved. We've had children who torture animals. We've had kids who eat our walls. Teens who run away repeatedly because they're going to be rejected again because of their behaviors. And those are the kinds of kids that you're asking the caseworkers to plan for and foster parents to keep. And supports for children in care and foster parents have been decreased over the last year and are looking at more reductions. The governor's talking about a 20% reduction in special care money. We haven't had an increase, even a cost of living increase in ages. I haven't had an increase on my children's personal care rates in 8 years. I have one little boy who wasn't trached and wasn't ventilated, and now he is, and there's been no change. I have to buy my kids glasses frames because the medical cards won't pay for them anymore. We have to change I have to call the doctor and change medications when they're sick because the state OMAP won't pay for them. If I get a kid in care on a Friday afternoon and it needs medicine, I have to go buy it. I can't get funded. I can't get it. I have to pay for it. Antibiotics are sometimes $150 for an 8-day course, and you will not get it funded. Christmas party, winter jack giveaways, those are great, but these children belong to the people of Oregon, the people that you represent, and we're the ones on the front line keeping them and trying to keep our houses up and trying to do everything right and trying to document. Caseworkers are having to depend on us more and more and more to do transportation for visits, to supervise those visits, to have icebreakers, to be the main people who are interacting with the parents, teaching parents, helping them learn how to parent. And we're getting tired, and we are overloaded, and there are no more foster parents coming up the pike. And retention and recruitment is incredibly important, and we're trying very hard to do that. But to be honest, I know a foster mom who's been a foster mom for 22 years, who's recruited and mentored people, who says she doesn't recruit anymore because she can't ask somebody to do what we're doing.
Kristen, can I ask you to wrap your comments up, please? We're almost out of time.
All right.
Thank you. I mean, your final thoughts.
I have recommendations in particular from the CAPTA panel that the GAPS program, the GAP process is in place, but it's being applied in different ways all over the state. The recommendation for the Multnomah County CAPTA recommendations for 2004, you can get on the internet. I have one copy with me. They recommend that mandatory reporting be required for every foster parent and every person who works in DHS. They'll tell you that it is and that they're getting it, but when I talk to people, they don't know what I'm talking about. Schools, student nurses, anyone who takes time with children should be in service on the CAPTA or on the mandatory reporting. And there's wonderful tape and wonderful stuff out there. It's just not getting to the people it needs to get to. Multnomah County has a child abuse hotline. I don't know that any other counties do. That's the place where the GAPS process should start. That should be the same all over the state. People should be able to access that. And like she said, don't reinvent the wheel. Let the medical program in Multnomah County help other counties to develop the same kind of programs. And I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for your comments. And if you have a copy of the report, you referenced the GAP report.
I do have
it. If you hand it to staff, they can make photocopies for all of us and then return that one to you.
And it's for every region in Oregon. It's not just Multnomah County.
Mr. Right. Chair, a very brief question. Please.
By all means.
My sister-in-law is a special ed teacher who deals with the kind of children you care for. And I was intrigued with you guys both do the work of the angels in dealing with those very difficult kids. How do you interact, the extent to which your kids are school age, with the special ed programs in the schools that are educating or at least caring for your kids during school time?
How do we interact?
You interact with the schools,
always,
the special ed programs.
We're the surrogate parent for all educational IEPs and special ed.
So you're in the development of the IEPs.
Oh, yeah.
Right. It's completely frontline work.
Caseworkers can't do it.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenick, and thank you both very much. Is there Anand Van Tron here?
My daughter.
All right. And Patrick Joseph Macwell?
Looks like you're in Cumberland as well.
Are you together?
Okay.
All right. Great. I appreciate you being here this morning, and we welcome you. And I'm sorry that we have a little bit of a time crunch, but we have limited opportunities for public meetings during legislative sessions. So if you could keep your comments to about 5 minutes, I would appreciate it.
Yes, sir.
But do your best. Thanks. Welcome. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Dato, and committee. My name is Yang Van Turen. I'm here to concern about DSS department, and I have a document here for each of you, but I have a children name in here. If you're not mind, if you can close it out, because I prepared this last night.
Sure.
Only 2 hours. What I'm concerned is, these children is not my children, and I volunteer, intervener, take care of the kid with my own money. I give you one example. The children get sick. The foster parent did not take the children to see a doctor. And I confront them and asking them, after 1.5 months, about 2 months, I took the children to see a doctor, and I have a document in here. And I pay my own money, and foster parent come out, yell at me, say, you take the children, go see a doctor, you pay for it. I said, don't worry, I worry about them, health concern. And children toy and Christmas and a birthday present been missing and broken, and I keep replacing. And Patrick Joseph is a half brother with that two brother and sister is my weakness, and I got to replace for them. What I concern is the department didn't follow court order, because I put in application for adopted these two kids almost a year last February, and I turned in application, and I have a 4 referral people. They never been checked. They keep leaving on. Suddenly, they push me out of the case. Secondly, caseworker did not check the children once a month. I talked to the children. They said maybe they see them maybe 2 or 3 times a whole year. The third, I have citizen review board recommend to department what to do, and they not follow up either. And the 4, when they send me to the psychologist evaluation, and I possibly pay for $1,000 with doctor recommended by DSS, and I check with my insurance says yes, they cover it. So my insurance give me the listed certain PSD for I can go see, and they said no, you cannot go see those people because they're not qualified. They send me back to the what they choose, and when they have a report, they won't give it to me. My attorney and I keep calling them, they won't answer the letter. They never answer the call. I called my good president, Cliff Zorner, last year. He called, he don't answer either. Finally, I went to the Senator President Peter Goodney, and his assistant called, somebody called. Less than an hour, the agency sent a copy to my attorney. And thus, I don't think I agree with the way how system works. And I sent a lot of letters concerned about the children to the case worker. I never received one answer letter from her, not one phone call. What I have is again me, accused me, and make all that accuse me I did wrong. I buy a lot. When I replace the stuff for the children, they say I bought too much. And I have all in here. And the casework are not consistent because every time they did something, they never tell us. I give you an example. They removed the two children from first parent to the second foster parent, and the second foster parent worked for ESS. And she know what she do, and he know what he does. And they did not notify the children appointed by the judge's attorney and my attorney and me. The day I come, pick the children up for go to the church, and I take us back. The day I take, go pick up the kid, go to the gymnastics I pay for, and the foster mom come out and said, the kid no longer live here. You need to contact with care worker. That's a Monday. And Tuesday, I went to sit down and DSF for 2 hours. They ignore me. I called Cliff Zorner, my girlfriend called. She not return call either. Finally, I told them, if nobody come out talk to me, I sit right there until I see supervisor, anybody in charge with this department. And finally, Kate Woodker show up.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Yes, Representative.
Sir, I'm a little confused. So are these your biological children who
no,
are
miss,
in?
No,
so I'm a little confused what your relationship
is. They're not related to me at all.
And so how do you know these children?
I know them because their mom is my ex-wife.
Oh, I see.
And okay. I know him when he born. And
this is one of the children about whom you were speaking, is that correct?
This the first one, and two, one still in foster
okay.
parent.
Okay.
And he stayed in foster parent too.
Okay, great. Could we hear from the young man, please?
Yes, Representative Tomei, thank you. Patrick, would you like to weigh in?
My name is Patrick Hackwell, Chair Dalto, representatives. What I'd like to talk about is the same thing that he's talking about. They, you know, I'm not trying to bash on DHS at all or anything, but I think they do a great thing for Oregon and everything. But I think that they... I don't want to say they don't work as hard as they can, because I do believe they do, but honestly, I think they could figure out a better system than what they have, because, you know, I've been in foster care for 2 years now, and I've had nothing but bad experiences with my caseworker. I mean, the caseworker that I have now is, you know, I like her because she's on the ball, she does what she says she's going to do. But my last caseworker, I only met with her, I think, 4 or 5 times. I mean, in a year and a half that I was living with my foster parents. And I think that they're supposed to do monthly checkups, so that was a big concern to me, you know. Also, another concern to me is that the... judge that we've been dealing with was planning on giving Nan his, like, the adoption rights, but then all of a sudden they just turned it over and said no, and said that, you know, this is a bad idea. And I've known Mr. Chung all my life, and there's nobody in this world that I'd rather those kids be with than him.
Patrick, let me ask you your ideas for how to improve the system, because you were suggesting that they need a better system. So what are your specific ideas?
Well, like, you know, they said that the monthly checkups, I think that, like, one of the other speakers today said that they should have, like a list to see who they've been checking up with, you know, and then also, like, report that they checked in with that, like, more often than they do. I don't know. And I think they could spend a little bit more time, like, with the kids. Like, when I was in foster care, I felt that, like, they spent more time with the foster parents than they did with the kids. Like, she just checked up on me, and then, you know, that was about it. It was like, you know, how are you doing? You know, okay, well, you know, I'll see you next time.
What kind of questions were you asked?
Like, she asked me a general questions, you know, how are you doing? You know, how do you like living here? Excuse me. You know, do you mind staying here? You know, is it a safe place? Is it a, you know, comforting place? And then that was about it. And then it was just, you know, okay, well, I'll see you next time.
What do you think she should have asked you? Or,
well, like, not even like ask me different questions. Just, you know, just spent a little bit more time with me. You know, just like, I don't know, just general things, you know, just even, you know, just sit down watching TV, talking about, you know, nothing. Just spending a little bit more time with the kids. Like, I think they spend, well, the one that I experienced spent a little bit more time with the foster parent than she did me.
And so your feeling is that you might have had a much better experience overall if you had more of an opportunity to interact with
yeah.
a caseworker.
Yeah.
You'd have felt better about.
Yeah, because it makes me feel like, you know, that she's just doing her requirements, you know, that she's not putting in that extra 10%, you know.
Okay.
She's just meeting her requirements, and that's it.
All right. Patrick, thanks very much. We're short on time, but we really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I say one more thing before...
One final comment, please.
Yes. I here to try to help in this system. I don't know how, but I put a lot of money on this kid, and I would like to see the chair consider look to the system. Let's see how much money we've been wasting. How many caregivers overworking? How many workers is that did not working? Because I went to San Francisco church, and sometimes I park my car at the Silverton Road, sit out at fairground, watch to see how many people come in late work, a lot. So I don't know how system work. What I do with it, I don't recommend. I cannot save a whole world, but I can save one child. That's all I get, and thank you very much for...
Thank you, and we appreciate it. I mean, it's very clear to us, at least to me, that you're going far and above any sort of reasonable expectation for the kids in your care that you care about. And I know that, you know, you described the special things that you've done to really make these kids feel good, so we appreciate it. And just so you know, because you may not have been here Monday, but we're trying to do sort of an overview of the system and get perspectives from many different people so that we can decide which direction we need to take to sort of improve the system as a whole. And we have two areas, really, child welfare and foster. And right now we're talking about foster, but we're going to tie them two together. So thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Tamari.
Sure. Although I also have letters for all of you.
Okay.
It has the child's name is in there. So.
Right. We'll hand it to Pamela. She'll hand it to me, and we'll decide what to do with it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Patrick. Don, is it Barland?
Darland.
Mr. Darland is our last individual signed up for public comment at this time, so we're going to have Mr. Darland keep his comments to about 5 minutes if possible. Then we're going to have... we're going to move on with our program.
We have Mr. Garland's written comment.
Good morning, Chair.
Excuse me, just one moment, please.
Sir.
Okay. Just some housekeeping items before you continue. It's clear to me that we're going to run out of time for our session today, and we wanted to carry over some portions of our session into Friday, but we have a complication with house rule that we put into place on the first day of the session, in that we have a 48-hour requirement to notice things in advance, which makes it challenging to be able to carry portions over. So I'm told that I have to announce my intention to carry over some portions of the testimony specifically dealing with the Court and Citizens Review Board for oversight of foster care cases with Nancy Miller. We're going to carry that over till Friday. We're also going to carry over part of the presentation of the Child Protective Services structure overall that we don't get to now. We will carry over till Friday, and we will hear from Sheriff Bernie Giusto and law enforcement right after Mr. Darling concludes his comments, and we will carry over any committee bills that we are considering introducing over to Friday. That way we can have an agenda posted right now so that we can meet the spirit of the 48-hour rule. So with that, thank you for your patience, Mr. Darling, and welcome. Good morning.
Thank you, Representative Dalto and committee members. I'm Don Darling. I'm the president of the Foster Parent Association of Oregon, and it's a pleasure to be here. I will make my comments very brief. I won't insult your intelligence. You can read my talking points, and that's just basically what they are. First of all, one of my mantras is rules without relationships lead to rebellion. A lot of what we're talking about in the foster care issues, the correlation between us and our caseworkers is about relationships. Even with the caseworkers and the children, it's about relationships. And so I'm hoping that through all this process that we can find a good way to increase what Representative Butler talks about as the outcomes, and we're going to need some increased relationships. And you can see my comments, you can follow policy to the letter and still get the wrong outcome for a child. That's just the facts. That's why we need to communicate. And, of course, we've already heard it today, caseworkers want to do social work, not paperwork. Just a couple things I want to touch on, then I'll close. How we do things, I guess, in our society, we value certain things. In fact, we have plumbers who have to have a certification because we value the work they do in our home, so we have flushable toilets. Well, our caseworkers, as overworked as they are, they have no certification requirement. They have no continuing education mandatory requirement. And here we have an opportunity to support them. And most of the caseworkers I've talked with, they said, we'd love to have that because it would force the system to support us in the work we do. So we would have the right training. And you have these young kids coming into the system, and they don't have the life experience as we do, maybe raising four or five children. They're struggling on how to communicate even with children. So that's one of the things, a certification might help us out. Because these workers are making life-threatening and life-changing decisions. So I think we need to value that with requiring them to have some certain education. And then, of course, the system has to support that. And unfortunately, that could mean more dollars. Some things around foster parents. We do have a high risk of founded abuse in our homes. That just comes with the territory. And I won't go into details why that is. But you can have enough founded abuse and be a foster parent, but you can't be a child care worker in the state, a licensed child care worker. Something to think about. And, of course, I've listed foster care reimbursement rates and some USDA USDA rates, and you can read those. We've already talked about face-to-face contact. Again, I go back to relationship. You can have a face-to-face contact, but if you spend an hour a month, or if the caseworker turnover is so high, you might see four or five caseworkers doing their face-to-face contact, but it's a different caseworker. And also, you might look at how that case file moves through the system. you'll have a CPS worker have it, then maybe an ongoing or permanency. You might have that case moving through the system, and that case file, every time it moves, it takes maybe a week or two to transfer that. So that's something you need to look at. Personally, the Oregon Foster Parent Association, and me personally, I am committed to work with Gary and Ramona to get things changed in this state and work with foster parents, train them properly. And I have to say, since Ramona came to this state, things have changed. I can guarantee it. I've been around 14 years, had about 50 kids through our home, and I've seen some major changes to the positive. So that's exciting for me. So I've listed some things, certification of workers, maybe even increase our certification for foster parents. 10 hours a year is not a whole lot of hours. Some foster parents might not agree with me on that. Rate redesign, we're actually working on that right now. And result of founded abuse, there's some things there that we might look at, contested case hearings. When foster parents are being revoked, their certification's being revoked, they have to represent themselves or they have to have an attorney. Most foster parents don't have the money to have an attorney. And some of them really don't know how to represent themselves. Maybe lay representation might be appropriate. Right now they're looking at a Bill of Rights for foster parents. Also, I've submitted the possibility of having a Bill of Rights for children. I don't think you can have one without the other. My last comment, I guess, is, or one of the last comments I continue to close, is that we need to leverage our funding. We have a pretty strong community in this state. I know the economics is down, but you know, we have some pretty good people in this state. And I think we can leverage the funding that we do have through either the faith-based community, nonprofits. Let's look at leveraging that funding and increasing that. So that's basically it, real quick, and I just appreciate your time, and I'd be more than welcome, more than happy to come back any time or have any questions and comments.
Thank you, Mr. Darling. Thank you. And I think we're going to have Sheriff Giusto coming up. Thank you so much. Almost can't get there.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bernie Giusto. I'm the elected sheriff in Multnomah County. A little professional background to give my remarks some context. I grew up with the Oregon State Police in law enforcement for 22 years and left there as lieutenant in 1996. Went to City of Gresham as chief of police, remained there for 6 years, and then took office as sheriff in 2003. My comments today will be completely on a different track than I think what you've heard before, and I'll let you know before I start, this is not about a condemnation of an agency or individuals, but I believe this committee is asking for a serious look at accountability in the system, regardless of what that means. Yeah. Let me take you back to my time as chief of police in Gresham. In July of 2001, a young lady by the name of Alexis Lopez, a young meaning 18 months, was murdered by her mother in Gresham City Park during a supervised visit. The details are somewhat important in that Mrs. Weston took the body of the juvenile, her daughter, to the funeral home and dropped her off. During another funeral, at which time we responded, we meaning Gresham Police. In the course of our investigation, we found that by talking to Mrs. Weston that she was on a supervised visit and that the caseworker aide was actually supposed to be in contact with her and could be found perhaps in the park on the other side, in a parking area on the other side of the park opposite of the funeral home. We arrived and after 45 minutes, having broken contact in that supervisor, that we notified Darrell Kraft that of the situation, and our investigation began. And as I said, it's not about whether or not there were mistakes made, but I want to go beyond just a second to tell you that what happened next was more concerning to me relative to your discussions. You know, accountability for the lives we protect, when you take a look at this uniform, it's pretty clear to you that police need to be accountable. We need to be accountable because we protect lives and property, and people expect a certain level of performance from us under all conditions. We need to have that accountability because it's the only way we develop trust in what we do. And it's the only way we get to tell people, and the decisions we make are generally respected, not always agreed with, but people rely on us to protect them based on their trust for us. It's really no different in what then was Search Children and Family. We started our investigation in the Weston case, and Mrs. Weston ended up with 25 years of a life sentence before parole was possible. What happened during the investigation more concerning than the events itself. I called last night to recontact my lead investigator, Detective Bob Peterson, and we reviewed the case. I want to be sure my memory is correct, and he obviously, we did on-the-ground work. Our relationship with the office in Gresham, no more than two blocks from the Gresham Police Department, is typically a pretty good relationship with the caseworkers there. We did a lot of work with them relative to child welfare issues. In this particular case, though, we were in full battle mode with the department in terms of the legal investigation. We found it not only very difficult, but we're roadblocked at every turn in terms of getting the information we needed for the investigation. The Department of Justice, representing them on the civil side, had every right to do whatever they needed to do. Unfortunately, in the business we're in, while the individual has rights to be protected from criminal prosecution, Mr. Kraft has every right in the world to invoke whatever right he wants. The public agency does not. Their responsibility is to answer to the public. The responsibility is to make sure that the information we get it can accurately and fairly portray the events that occurred. This was a very extended investigation for a police department that should not have had to spend this much time finally getting to a conviction of Mrs. Weston. Let me say about the fact that individuals involved in the investigation weren't cooperative to some degree, but the tone between two public agencies when the public's welfare is at risk and proven to be an issue of performance is pretty concerning to me. After 30 years in this profession, I don't think that my hide's very... I've got tough hide. I don't have a lot of expectations other than what is based in reality. But at the point at which I can no longer explain why things occur, then I have to ask myself what's got to be different in terms of the accountability issue to the public.
Sheriff, could I ask you a question,
you
please? How long ago did this happen?
This happened in July of 2001.
Do you think that things have changed since then?
Well, Representative, I'll ask. I'd have to make that rhetorical. That was the first of a string of fairly high-profile cases.
Okay.
So the comments I'm making really aren't about whether or not the day-to-day work is getting done fairly. I think that caseworkers are committed. I have had a lot of experience working with caseworkers, at the state police or in just general conversations at conferences or wherever. So that's really not the issue. The issue is really more about the system. It has really little to do with the individual. And I think that what you're trying to take a look at is a system fix, a system look, if maybe not a fix, but a system look to see what it is that might assure better protection for our kids. As I said, there's really no difference between what law enforcement does and what this agency does. Not much, except that we carry guns. But the responsibility for life and for us property is much the same as responsibility for the lives of children and families that this agency represents. So how we come to that decision, how those resources are managed, are just as important in terms of accountability as ours are. I'm not here to argue whether more resources are good or more resources are needed or that'll make any difference, but more resources won't make any difference if the rubber doesn't meet the road in terms of policy and procedure. So let me be specific with you in what I'm recommending to you, please. I'm recommending, and I have, and I'm here at the speaker's invitation after meeting with her, and I should tell you that I met with the speaker a session ago about this issue, in prior to the 2003 session. And we talked in generalities about it. I'd made some general comments about it. And I think neither of us probably, let me speak for me, not the speaker. I didn't probably follow up the way I needed to. I'm now following up. Number one, I recommend that this committee and the legislature consider an internal affairs or inspection unit with trained investigators located outside the agency reporting to an outside authority with clear legislative and statutory authority.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Yes. Do you have written testimony?
I don't. What I can say.
You will distribute these things for us.
I will get you some. I'm sorry, Representative. Thank you.
Representative, we can also get video and audio of the transcript so we can go over. Yeah.
We need the recommendations in front of us.
Representative Jensen.
I just want to be clear. You're talking about an internal affairs for the agency, not for the police.
Right. Thank you, Representative. That's correct. Internal affairs or inspection unit.
Yep. Okay.
Number two, that agency, that unit to have unilateral access to field offices for unannounced visits, for public records, public interviews, employee interviews, and supervisory case management review. Also, independent access to internal affairs, public access to the internal affairs unit to field citizen concerns without going through the agency. Number four would be consider giving the unit some independent authority to make as a separate decision points as to the status of cases in terms of in any child welfare in maybe any or defined child welfare, some child welfare cases. Their appellate authority. A little bit more about my background. I have spent time on the Human Rights Commission, appointed by Mayor Katz, Children and Family Services Commission. I was a charter member appointed by Chair Stein. So I don't want you to believe I come with this uniform with a hard heart. But here's what I've learned about taking care of people. It takes more than a good heart. It takes accountability. Police do not like internal affairs units. Do you think my cops or any cops I work with like internal affairs? They don't. But we know it's necessary because they know that in any given day, their action can lead to review of their processes, of their performance. It's not necessarily about caseworkers. It's not necessarily about management. It's about the entire system and the accountability that you're asking for. More resources may be necessary. Again, not here to comment on that. I can throw a lot of cops at things, but without the right kind of processes, getting the service to the ground really doesn't make any difference.
Mr. Chair? Second.
Thank you, and that's all I have.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit about how internal affairs works for the police and what kind of appellate power they have or responsibility?
Every agency has a little different internal affairs process. Basically, if it works correctly, the public has direct access to it, not having to call anybody else in the agency. They should be able to call directly into the internal affairs function and state their concern. All the way from, I saw a deputy, he was driving too fast, to somebody used excessive force against me last night. And then that unit should be able to act not independent of the agency, but with separate authority to act without any need to talk to anybody, perhaps maybe the chief executive. That's how it ought to work. In some places, complaints get filtered in a number of ways. When I was at Gresham, it got filtered in through my office oftentimes. Somebody called, they called ISOC, got to Internal Affairs, or they called Lieutenant, and they got Internal Affairs, and that still happens. But you cannot not be able to have them call somebody independent of the inspection unit itself. In terms of the appellate authority, Internal Affairs very seldom has the final say. It's usually the chief executive that has the final say in that situation. And I'm not sure that in this case I'd recommend that the chief executive not have anything to say about it, nor there be any communication with that office. And originally I believed that when I talked to the speaker a session ago, that perhaps Internal Affairs could be located within the agency. I think maybe over time it could, and I think initially not. And that reporting line doesn't have to be not to the agency. It just can't be diluted by the agency. Nobody's trying to catch anybody doing anything. Nobody doesn't trust people do not do their work. That's not really the point. It's not how many cases you see or how many people you're not able to see, but it's to see that in the cases that we talk about, whether the high-profile cases mean anything or not, nobody's talking about saving every kid from a bad experience in Oregon. But where there are glaring errors, to believe that somehow somebody's good heart will fix those is not going to work. It's going to be because somebody's not paying close attention.
Yes. Mr. Chair?
I'm going to ask one more question, then I'll give it over to you. So it seems to me that our prime issue is the children and the protection of the children and the children's privacy. So I'm wondering if that doesn't put a little more of a curve into this issue with the agency rather than a police internal audit.
Well, let me say this. If I'd sent a police officer to take care of a child in the park as part of their duty, I don't know what happened. Maybe we had a homicide where we had to take the children from the house briefly, or we had a meth lab where we removed the kids briefly, and I put that in that officer's custody, and the officer decides to read a newspaper instead of take care of the child. The child runs out the street, gets killed. We'd be having ourselves an internal affairs investigation.
Yeah.
So there is no twist in the situation. How the information is treated, as you've treated it in terms of names and that kind of thing, that can be dealt with internally. The issue really isn't any one individual child. It's a process that protects all the children.
Got it. Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions, please. The first question is, how do you see this unit interacting with the management and supervision of an agency particularly? I mean, we want to hold the agency accountable. That means we want the managers to manage and the supervisors to supervise.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe in the police example, that police that's out to lunch when they should be working isn't a supervisory matter. Maybe it's an internal affairs matter, but in normal organizations, we want the managers to manage. Somehow I sense you that this is independent and separate from the routine management structure. And the second question is, you obviously have strong feelings about the 2001 investigation, and I wonder if you could specifically talk about how, had this internal affairs unit been in place at the time, it would have changed your relationship with the agency in terms of the investigation of that murder.
Well, a couple of things. Thank you very much, Representative. Let me start with the last question. The relationship between police and child protective agencies, I don't care where they are, is always not difficult, but challenging one, because sometimes our interests may be a little different, not in terms of the final result protecting the child, but in terms of how we have to deal with the family, very specifically. I think this kind of unit creates much more common ground for a joint type investigation relative to any such incident. Sometimes the relationship between workers in one agency and cops in another agency is mainly a language issue. I think a unit that has intimate knowledge of the culture, what are the expectations, what are the performance measures, how we're meeting those, relative to delivering service, case management flow. In the case of Gresham, would have probably broken down a lot of barriers, or at least not raised them so quickly and not so dramatically. I've never seen barriers raised like that in an investigation between two public agencies.
Well, Mr. Thank you. Follow up. I mean, let me give you a hypothetical. Mm-hmm. Let's say that one of your sheriff's officers was suspected of abusing a child that was in foster care in the agency,
mm-hmm.
and that came first under your internal affairs
mm-hmm.
Investigation. You would imagine that the internal affairs unit of the child protection group would be interested in this, and then you would imagine they would come to you and you would create a joint investigation of that? Is that how you would imagine that work?
It could, Representative. In the scope of what this unit does could be as broad or as narrow as legislative authority allows. They could join in that. They could be the independent as far as most agencies can be concerned. And we do that from time to time with the child abuse team in Portland, is that we turn over investigations to them and we don't get involved in them, even when they involve police officers. That's the criminal investigation piece, the internal affairs investigation piece about what happens to them as employees. And that's more what I'm talking about in this case, is that's coming back to me at some point to make a decision about how that unit might interact with and this gets to the first question, how that unit might interact with supervisory ranks at the department is, I think, a matter of probably both the personalities and the management of the unit in agreement with the top management at the department. I wouldn't be asking for exclusive authority for this unit, only to investigate, only to act, not to act unilaterally with employees in terms of their employment.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Just a quick question. Do you think that the new CERT team is going to be doing the same thing as an internal affairs unit might?
No.
Okay.
I think it'll do a lot of after action stuff. I don't think it'll have a accountability piece in it. I think it'll have a lot of record. I've read the proposal. I've seen it. I think it's a very good thing. And let me say this first of all. I think it's a very good thing. I don't think it drives accountability to the ground. But that's just coming from a guy who's lived in an agency where even as good, and I have to tell you, cops are good-hearted people. I want you to know they are. They're good people, but they're people. And that's why we have internal affairs units. I mean, people believe we have internal affairs units so that if we shoot somebody, we go out and investigate it, or in case somebody accuses us of beating them, we go out and do it. That's 1% of why we have them. We have them because they don't do reports sometimes. We have them because they're impolite to citizens. That's why we have them. And what comes with that is belief in citizens that if they have a concern, regardless of how small or how big, that it's going to get addressed. And they may not like the answer, but it's going to get addressed. And in many cases, it tells the cops, I just got to walk that straight and narrow. That's all.
So, Sheriff, I just want to be clear about this. You are... you're saying that any sort of internal affairs process, at least in your experience with law enforcement, is more of a sort of proactive piece to catch problems ahead of time and try to implement some sort of corrective action to improve the situation looking out into the future.
That's correct.
The majority of what you do, irrespective of large incidents or things like that.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, great. Representative Butler, you had a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that there's an ombudsman in the governor's office. You're talking about something well outside of the scope of an ombudsman program.
Yes, Representative, I am. Actually, much like if you went to the state police today, they have a professional standards unit. It's internal affairs. You can call anything you want. It's internal to the police department. But policing cultures come with an enforcement mentality, and you must have an enforcement mentality, not meaning a harsh, hand-heavy police state mentality, but to make internal affairs work, you have to have the willingness to both criticize, critique, correct, and discipline, and terminate. that's what you have to be able to do. Ombudsman takes complaints and then, for instance, and sends it to state police, and state police finds out whether or not they need to do internal affairs. They might take a complaint about the department and send it to a manager. This one comes with some swift certainty about it.
Sheriff, what is your confidence level with the internal affairs process as a whole? Are you very confident with the results?
I am as a whole. Do I agree with the level of discipline or non-discipline in those situations? Not always. But policing this state, people ought to be grateful for the policing we have. My experience around the nation wouldn't be quite so confident. Internal affairs can be cumbersome, doesn't have to be, depends on who the chief executive is. But in terms of results, I think people, if in fact I today were to go out to the public and tell them I was going to do away with my internal affairs, or the city of Portland was going to do away with their internal affairs, and we were just going to go ahead and deal with it, you know, you call and you got a complaint, we'll somehow fix it. They're gonna come right off the wall. So, and rightfully so, they see us in that authoritarian role. But it's more than what our authority. It's our responsibility to protect the public, maintaining public trust.
Representative Anderson.
Chair, two questions. Is the internal affairs activity possibly carried out, could it be possibly carried out by the Citizens Review Board that each county has? And number two, is this type of suggestion or recommendation you're making best handled on a county, regional, or statewide basis?
Thank you, Representative. Ideally, you know, the smaller you can break it down, the better, but I'm afraid for consistency, and this is where the question comes that Representative Greenlick had, I can answer a little further. It probably ought to be handled on a statewide basis. That would require, because no units could have enough people to do everything, that would require a close working relationship with the department to look into issues and matters and those kind of things. While I say I'd like to see it on a local level, I'm afraid of the inconsistency issue. I think for consistency's sake, it needs to be managed by a statewide unit through the department for quality control.
Representative Jensen.
And the Citizens Review Board, we already have a board in each county, I believe, that reviews cases. Should this be thrown on their backs, or is it bigger?
I don't know if it's bigger. I think it's different. I think it's different. And I'd have to know a little bit more about how they function. But
okay. Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I want to follow just a little bit on Representative Anderson's and your question, one of his questions and your response to it in relationship to whether it should be a state or local or regional or, you know, whatever. I think I would probably agree with your answer that there'd be a great deal of inconsistency, or the possibility of inconsistency if it's on a local level. But I guess I would ask in relationship to that, if such is not exactly the case as far as the police departments around the state. They are at a local level, and I suspect there's a significant difference between internal affairs in Multnomah County, mm-hmm. the Sheriff's Department, and perhaps even the City of Portland's Multnomah Affairs Department, let alone my town or my Sheriff's Department sort of thing.
Yeah. No question about it. In terms of your comments, the inconsistency, however, can't be within the same agency. So while state police deal with theirs on a Baker City, Bend, Coos Bay office in terms of discipline, the final outcome is centralized and the final outcome is agreed upon at headquarters in a central place. I'm talking about more the inconsistency between field offices relative to any final outcome of discipline.
Follow up, a little different question, or another question. this one has to do with, you know, your as I mean, my perceptions of internal affairs, of course, is compliments of the television set, and I appreciate that likely to be distorted at times, so we won't even go into that. If I understood you correctly, that the real benefit of an internal affairs, has to do with the little issues rather than when you've got, quote unquote, a dirty cop or something of that nature. As contrasted to the topic that we've been on here, would you envision that that this statewide internal affairs, would deal with those kind of issues, or are they going to be instead, or would you propose instead, they're kind of a critical incident response team?
More of the former, Representative, and what I mean by that is teaching an agency or teaching any group of individuals that work under the kind of the same expectations how to manage their performance, manage their service to the street or whatever, is both possible and preferable as opposed to holding it out as some kind of a hammer. So this, I think, initially this group might be helping advise the department on things that are brought to their attention by the public and comes to their attention through office visits, and explaining to them or trying to get them to accept the fact that this is a good time to talk to this employee about why this case isn't being managed correctly, why the supervisor isn't doing case management. I think it's a lot more of that, and that's the part that really how the public views the agency, is not whether or not they respond after a child's been in a very unfortunate situation or dies. That, of course, erodes confidence as well, but that kind of thing can happen. More importantly is, are the everyday services that they come to get, or the way that those services are being delivered, according to what the protocols are in somewhat a consistent manner across the agency.
Thank you.
Thanks. We need to move on from the internal affairs questions, but I have a couple of questions of my own. Sheriff, where did you start your career?
Oregon State Police.
Oregon State Police. And you've been doing law enforcement for how long?
30 years.
And so how have you, and I don't know at the state police level how your interactions might be with child protective issues, but how have you seen child welfare as a whole from the law enforcement perspective evolve from when you started your career?
Well, I think I started by saying, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I started by saying that I'm not here to criticize, because when I can do it all better, I'd let the agency know I've got the answers. I don't. It's evolved greatly. It's come a long ways, and the situations have become way more, much more difficult. Issues way more complex. Children's lives way more complex. Way more children with way more complex lives. Good things have happened. I'd be the first to tell you that I believe, in my experience, things are better. The relationship between law enforcement and I think the department is in Oregon have improved greatly. And since Ramona's been here, I think she's worked hard at that. That may be a different question in terms of when we ask them what's changed in the area of accountability, and I don't mean expense accounts.
Sheriff, I'm not talking about accountability. I want to know, as the circumstances have changed, as the child abuse situations have become much more complicated, as you add drugs and alcohol into it, how has your interaction as being law enforcement's interaction is a critical component of the overall system change? In other words, was it the case 25 years ago that that law enforcement had a much freer access to information about what was happening in a specific child's home? Or, it's hard for me to have a conception of what child abuse settings were like, you know, in the past. But what I'm getting at is I want to know about the progression of the flow of information, because it's clear to me from the conversations that we've been having for the past week or so, one of the critical holdups, short of the, you know, the caseload, short of the money, short of all that, it's the free flow of information between a department internally, the Department of Human Services at the field office level with their supervisory structure, and then with law enforcement, and then with the judicial system, and then you add in these new regulations all the time, HIPAA and all sorts of privacy issues. I think it's impeding the flow of information. It's critical to do the best possible job in protecting those kids. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get your experience about how that's changed.
Well, let me just be real direct. I don't think that's changed much in my 25 years. I don't think it's a lack of willingness, maybe a local level, maybe a personality complex. But in my time at Gresham, where we did a lot of that, and we still do a lot of it, the sheriff's office through civil process, is that, I'm not going to point fingers at anybody, is that the information sometimes comes very difficult and very incomplete fashion, and it could be in both directions as far as I know. Sometimes we will get the sheriff just discussed this yesterday. Sometimes sheriffs will come to, sheriff's office will be inundated with 40, 50 faxes, of which, and sharing information is terrific, where everything from, you know, too dirty a diaper to suspected, you know, marks on a child. So sometimes it's not only the information, it's what the information is and how valuable it is, and how we can sort through it and how we can communicate better back. The working relationships, I think, are fine when we get to them. If we have to take children from homes, which we did just last week, my office did, that relationship seems to be pretty good. But that's, of course, at the very end of the process in some cases. So we have our moments when our missions don't kind of line up in terms of what we do. I think that's, we're working on it. Anything you can do legislatively in terms of the confidentiality issues to break down those walls so that information is available to us would be very helpful. Or if you mandated that information to law enforcement, would be very helpful.
Yeah, Sheriff. You're talking about law enforcement arriving at a situation when it's already become pretty serious. Now, is law enforcement, from your perspective, getting involved too late?
Well, unfortunately, Representative, Mr. Chair, we're not. We're late in some cases. We're becoming primary responders at meth houses. So, as complex as the things were before, we oftentimes are the first ones in the door with then trying to go to the department to get some help, because to no fault of their own necessarily, didn't even know that the meth house with another child was living in that condition. So we're either late or we're too far on the front edge and need more immediate resources more immediately, more often.
And what happens in the middle? Are you staying in the cases where you're arriving as the first responder? Are you staying with that situation through the entire child welfare process?
Well, the Multnomah County is a little different. I'll just speak for that. Because of our child abuse team, where all child abuse cases are referred, except for very few. I know that Portland Police in the combined team do stay with it start to finish. They get a kitchen investigation, they stay with it, the department stays with it, and they're together in that combined team. That child abuse team works very well in Multnomah County, although the numbers are incredible in terms of what they're trying to deal with.
So, Sheriff, how can we improve communications then between your frontline folks, I don't know if they're deputies or whomever, but between your folks and child welfare workers?
Well, like I think you've heard this before, today, the training issues and the time for training, I guess we're going to have to decide where we're going to give up some give up some service, because training has to come first, and cross-training has to come first in terms of developing a common language and some face-to-face kind of familiarity. I'm sympathetic to the situation where the caseworker turnover, and that's maybe what we're suffering most from, is the fact that nobody comes long enough for us to develop a long-term relationship, because there have been, in my career, people that I've known 20 or 25 years who left and retired from that agency. I'm guessing now that that's a small percentage of people.
So. Sheriff, do you have people within your agency that specialize in the child welfare area? In
yes.
other words, so if you have a deputy that rolls on some incident and then they find something, do they then sort of hand it to another deputy or something that specializes in child welfare?
We do, but that person now is part of the child abuse team in Multnomah County. But in most agencies of any size, somebody knows child abuse, has either been on the team or has come back to the agency. When I was at Gresham, we had two officers that are back at Gresham now that catch child abuse cases.
Is the continuity issue that you speak of within the caseworkers from the Department of Human Services side extend to law enforcement?
The continuity of our deputies and officers?
Yeah.
I mean, do they come and stay?
No. Yeah. I mean, what you're saying is some of the challenges are in your. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but in your experience, some of the challenges on the child welfare side are that you may have, you know, a rotation of child welfare workers or some kind of turnover, and I'm just trying to get a sense of how much that is an issue within law enforcement.
It's not the same issue, and I'll just be very frank. Of course, it's a little different law enforcement because you need to be certified depending where you work. You competition for the job is very high. The typically 4 to 6% turnover in law enforcement agencies, somewhere in the area of 4 or 6%. Most people come and stay. Some people move on to other law enforcement agencies, but our turnover issue is not like theirs.
All right. We're going to have to wrap this up, but one final question for me, and then if anybody on the panel wants to weigh in. Can you give us some recommendations, and you don't know, now, but maybe, you know, in the coming weeks as we kind of go over this, sort of specific recommendations about layers, impediments that we can peel back mm-hmm. from your communication, because again, I'll reiterate, you know, I think that's one of the real major keys, and so if you could be perfectly clear to us about, you know, specific communication roadblocks, because I don't want anybody to run into any roadblocks or any walls when it comes to trying to get information about protecting kids. So I think we all need to be part of this process of figuring out how we can do this better in the future. So I don't know if you have any thoughts now or in the future.
I think I'll reserve my thoughts for later. I'll make some specific recommendations after talking to a few people. I'll send the committee those in writing.
Sure. And Sheriff, may I ask you also, if it isn't too much of an imposition, but to talk with some of your colleagues, elected sheriffs across the state. And I don't know if you have some form that gets everybody, but if you can to have other people weigh in so we can have a great representation from all corners of the state.
I will do that.
Yeah, thank you very much. Any final comments from the panel here? I sort of dominated that a little bit, but Sheriff, appreciate you very much for coming down and working with us, and we'll see you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
At this point, colleagues, we're sort of over time, and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to move the overview from the Department of Human Services over to Friday, and appreciate the department being here and bearing with us and being willing to come back on Friday. I'm grateful for that. I'm gonna close our session with one more individual, a member of the public that wanted to comment. And so, if I could invite Elaine Jenkins in, or up front to testify, Elaine, if I could ask you to keep your comments to about 5 minutes, then we'll adjourn this meeting. Thank you.
And I want to thank you for seeing me, Chair Galdo, and members of the panel. I'm here today because I'm a probation officer with Marion County Juvenile Department.
Elaine, can I ask you to introduce yourself? Right?
Elaine Jenkins.
Thank you.
And my name's Elaine, and I have worked in the juvenile justice system for 23 years. I appreciate your hearing me today. I was a bit late signing up because I had some stuff to do at work this morning before I came. So I wanted
to. Well, glad you did.
I wanted to share some comments to you, and I think you're very wise in trying to tie child welfare issues in with foster care issues, because they're very much connected, and there are some problems when we don't have a full system that works. I have some written comments that I'll leave to you, but in the interest of time, I'm going to try and get some highlights. Today, you're looking at the services offered to children and families by the Department of Human Resources, Child Welfare, and you've heard many stories, and will hear many stories about the deficiencies in this agency. The truth is that I believe, in the years that I've worked with them, they have an almost impossible job. We demand that they look to preserve families. At the same time, we demand they keep children safe. They work under strict guidelines that attempt to protect the rights of adults and to protect children and look for their best interests as well as reunite families. Sometimes these goals, folks, are mutually exclusive. They do this job with fewer resources and with a growing number of children in need. I will tell you, in Marion County, I believe there are like 1,200 children in foster care. There are more needed. And what we experience at the juvenile department is that I have, and other caseworkers have, clients that get stuck in detention, that get stuck in our guaranteed attendance program, which is turned into a de facto shelter care, because there are not enough homes for the children who are pre-adjudicated, so they're not wards of the court, and there are no resources in the youth authority, and there are no resources in DHS to deal with these children with really special needs that have the possibility of hurting other people in our community. And they're young. Some of them are 11 and 12. And we expect these people to do this job in an environment where the problems are increasingly complex. I have sat for 23 years in court, and I have listened to dependency cases. And I thank God that I didn't get hired at CSC, because I think I would have had a really difficult time trying to negotiate the hurdles and the demands of those people's jobs. You hear about a lot of high-profile cases. You read them in the newspaper, you hear them on TV, and you've heard some here. The truth is that these people are trying to do their job with the conditions that this body has laid out for them, that's mandated by federal government guidelines as well, and they're trying to provide services to families in a system where they don't always have the information about who the clients are that they're dealing with. There was a time, and I'm not sure if it was if it's still accurate, but they weren't able to look up criminal records of people who were referred to them, so they had no idea who they were working with. We assigned them the task of doing all this. At the same time, over the last 23 years, we have pulled away from them the tools that they had when I first started in my career. We have contracted out to various public agencies and community organizations the resources that help pull families together and assess families, and we do that to save money. And we do that at the expense, I believe, of our children, because many of these agencies are very nice, well-meaning people. But they have less training than we're talking about the brand new caseworkers that, you know, flood our courtroom every day. They don't know the depths of the problems, and they are not prepared to deal with them. Whenever we contract out problems with our children to essentially lay people, we are losing. And it's not because these people have bad intentions, it's because they just don't have the skills, ability, or knowledge to do all that stuff. I'm going to kind of tell you, kind of summarize my concerns in the stories of three young women. And they're three young women that I know, and I'm going to call them April, May, and June. April's situation is indicative of someone who's been on my case for the last few years. She's 17 years old. She has a history of, she doesn't have an extensive history with the juvenile justice system. In fact, this is the first time she's been referred. And what is true about young women is they don't generally have an extensive history with the juvenile justice system. They do low-level chronic things like shoplifting and some drug use, or they kind of avoid detection. And so they don't generally get services. But April lives with a grandmother, and April has done that because her parents are both involved with drug and alcohol use and have their own legal problems and are in and out of jail. She was placed eventually with a grandmother who is a very nice, well-meaning lady, but is also disorganized and scattered in her own life. So April came to see me because she had been involved with methamphetamines and she has a methamphetamine charge. So she, for a long time, has needed treatment for this, even before she got to my desk. But in her life, if you don't have insurance and you don't qualify for the Oregon Health Plan, then you don't find resources. To think about going to counseling with the family is between $280 and $400 and some dollars, $500 a month, because it costs between $60, which was the low end when I started working, and about $120 an hour for a private therapist. How can you put that in a budget when you don't have money and you don't have a very high-paying job? April's been sexually abused, but she hasn't had treatment for that abuse either. And we are trying to work to try and help April find the resources she needs in this system of trying to put things together. I will now tell you about May. She has, I believe, three children in DHS foster care. I knew May when she was about 10 years old, and she was referred for stealing and other aggressive behavior. She was not a child that DHS was able to serve. Her family situation was very marginal. Her parents possibly could have gotten her treatment, but their lives were so scattered and disorganized. And they were centered on their own problems and their own daily survival that they didn't have a whole lot of ability to deal with May's problems. She didn't surface again after her case was closed by us because she completed her probation requirements. But she did drop out of school. She did start using drugs. And she grew up and ran away from home and became involved with a series of abusive men. She is currently struggling with a methamphetamine addiction. And she really, you know, wants to take care of the children, but the truth is she doesn't have the personal skills and knowledge and sense about herself that gives her the ability to do that. And then I'm going to tell you about June. And she's a young woman on my caseload when she was 12. She had a very chaotic family life, and her home life was difficult, and her older sister, who I also knew, had some major problems in her life. But June became part of a support group. These were for girls at risk, and it happened when she was in the seventh grade. Our drug and alcohol specialist that was grant-funded on the youth services team was able to go and spend time each week throughout the school year and make contact during the summers with this group of young girls, and there were six of them there. And she did this for 5 years. Their senior year in high school, it was picked up by another drug and alcohol specialist because she had quit and found another job. So June is currently, of this group of six girls, none of them got pregnant. All of them completed high school. And five of them chose not to use drugs and alcohol again. They got the support they needed from a consistent professional adult in their life who cared about them, who came and saw them, and who nurtured them and gave them the support that they needed. June is now in college, and she's wanting to become a psychologist. It is a success story. And for a relatively small amount of money, we have taken what could have been a really big problem, and we have made it into a success. What I will tell you now is the drug and alcohol specialists on our grant no longer do those sorts of things. They do an 8 to 10 a week evidence-based program, and their plan, because there's fewer of them now, is to move from school to school throughout Marion County and present this. So we've lost services. And what I find is that we lose direct contact services with kids that we can help. And we've done this because we've given the money away to other organizations. I believe that the lives of our children are very important. I believe that we have this artificial tug of war between prevention and intervention, and it is artificial because the children that we are trying to prevent abuse with today are the adolescents that we gave up on last year. those are the parents that we need to reach before they have children. And I urge you to look in the darkness. Dr. Garbino, James Garbino, he's a lecturer and a director of the Family Development Center and professor of human development at Cornell University, wrote a book called Lost Boys. And he writes, consider Joe, who on the way home from a meeting walks down the street and sees George, down on his hands and knees under the lamppost. He asks George what he's doing, and George tells him he's looking for his keys. He decides to help George and tell George they need to use a public health approach. They make a grid under the lamppost and do a thorough survey of the session, and they find their keys. They try a behavioral approach. They give him NMs. And the searching behavior continues, but yet there are no keys. Then they try a psychoanalytic analytical approach. They try an intercultural analysis and discuss the history of keys under Western civilization. They have a campaign to find the keys. And then they try the New Age approach. Finally, something radical happens. They ask George where he lost the keys. And he lost the keys about 150 yards down there. And so Joe asks, why in the world, George, are you looking here? And it's because the light is better here. We need to look into the darkness. We need to help this agency do the job that we asked it to do. And you are the people that need to do that. Over the last 23 years, I've seen us do less looking in the dark and more looking in the light, and I hope that you will change that. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Representative Bloom.
One quick question. I just want to clarify. You made a comment about prevention versus intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And could you just say that again, because maybe I got it wrong.
What I have seen is that with, I will say, the discretionary money, the money that is not spent, to do the mandated casework.
Mm-hmm.
What I have seen is that this body and the communities at large have gone back and forth between how we spend it. And there is a move to do prevention work with, you know, so we want to make sure that little kids are safe. Healthy Start, which is kind of a holy grail, is one of those prevention activities that we do. The problem is that who does the Healthy Start volunteer, a trained volunteer, but a volunteer nonetheless, goes to someone's home and they deal with the parents and look at, you know, talk to the parents and try and make sure that this child is okay. The parent is the person who we didn't give the intervention services to, you know, the year or two before she got pregnant. Mm-hmm. So we have an artificial separation between doing prevention and intervention, and in truth, they're very much combined. These children, these young women that I talked about, these are the parents that we will be doing, that will be seeing DHS, Child Welfare Services, for their children, unless there's an appropriate intervention. These will be these are the parents, the children who will be in foster care.
Thank you. Thanks very much. With that, we're adjourned.
Okay, I've got to get this agenda out.